Thank you very much, Tony. I'm honoured to be talking to you today, and I'm very pleased that there are so many of you still here. I would have understood you'd decided that the day had reached its crescendo before tea, so I'm thrilled. And as I think you've heard, as a newly installed Butler Trust trustee, I was very keen personally to rekindle the links between the Butler family and its efforts to recognise, develop and disseminate good prison work and the Institute of Criminology. And I think this has been achieved and talked about already during the day, so I just want to add my enthusiasm for the project. I also want to add my personal thanks to Simon Shepherd and Malcolm Butler for inviting me onto their board. So as you've obviously all heard, this is quite a day for me, as I've been torn between joining in with this very exciting programme, which I was very committed to, and discussing wisdom and personal growth with the Dalai Lama. How many people have that problem to contend with in their working lives? Shad Varuna, Dalai Lama? Fortunately...
made the right choice.
I knew Shad wouldn't mind if I teased him. I think, amazingly, I think, I hope, that what I try to say, my head's still a little bit in space, that if I can draw my thoughts back together, then what I have to say this afternoon will draw some of the threads together, actually, between the themes of this morning and my topic. So my topic is trust and the role of the prison officer. And I don't mean to be exclusive about the uniformed prison officer. There are obviously other prison staff for whom what I have to say is also relevant. But I do want to say quite a lot today about what it is that officers and other staff are doing when they grow people in highly skilled ways. And I want to show you some empirical findings that support the case that moral climates in prison make the difference between life and death, or between peace and violence. So what happens in a prison seems to be a concentrated version of what happens in the world. And paradoxically, we sometimes seem able to see things more clearly in the intense, closed and sensitive environment of a prison than we do in the world outside. So somehow both bests and worsts get exaggerated, they become visible, and their effects are measurable. So today I want to talk in particular about trust and its role in the moral, social and organisational life of high security prisons. Some of what I have to say will challenge aspects of current practice, but all the best working practices I cite already exist out there, and therefore more of them are clearly achievable. And as ever, I hope what I have to say has relevance beyond the high security estate. So this is my outline. Two brief case studies of ordinary but outstanding prison work, a methodologically creative study of the location and building of trust in prison and the rationale for the study, some findings, some theory, I-it, I-thou relations, and the concept of emergent personhood, then something on why intelligent trust matters in the good use of authority, and then why outstanding prison officers or prison staff are special and why we need more of them but fewer prisoners. I'm going to start by breaching my own outline, so I want to jump to the middle and give you just a very brief account of what happened next since we left our two main research establishments, since this is exciting and new, and it sets the tone for my discussion of the project, which has taken me back to appreciative inquiry in a major way. One of the first people I've made friends with in my new world over there today is a passionate appreciative inquiry advocate. So if you can make sense of these case studies as I briefly talk about them, talking about trust seems to have generated energy for change. Far from being naive or misguided, as we were warned it might be at the start of our project, prisoners and staff have responded to a study of trust with openness, energy and hope. So refreshing and important has this been, they now tell us, that they've decided to carry on talking about it without us. I'm hoping this is a bit of technology that I really wanted, which is a pointer thing. Yes, it works, so I can point at things. Thank you, Julia. So the prisoners have decided that they liked talking about trust, that this did something, and so they've carried it on. And so, quite independently, prisoners at Frankland and Full Sutton have initiated committees, work groups, or organised forms of dialogue around the themes of relationships and working together, at which what they describe as awakenings are taking place and changes to practice are being negotiated. So we've been getting letters, we've been back for some visits, we have sources of information coming from all sorts of places, and we're finding that this has just happened by itself. So on A Wing in Full Sutton, this dialogue includes what one prisoner has called a diversity awakening, out of which better questions and answers are permissible among prisoners about different faiths and faith practices. This subtle shift in focus from risk and fear or distance to trust and talk and proximity seems to be potentially transformative. We're returning to the establishments in various ways, for example, to engage in a joint feedback seminar at Full Sutton, where we can talk about our findings, but prisoners also want to talk at that event with us about what they've been doing since we left and the impact that this is having. So I think this is important. One of the many inspiring encounters during this project was with a horticulture instructor at Frankland. He loved growing things, so much so that when I mentioned that a particular daisy he grew at Frankland was the same daisy I'd once grown in my garden but had lost, he gave me two pots to take home that night. They're now thriving in my garden. He loved growing plants so much, he shared this love with prisoners, or actually anyone else who showed an interest. So this love came before his thinking about risk or progress or prison or even prisoners. So what prisoners felt from him was a shared focus on something other than their dangerousness or their need to change. Sometimes, he told me, if they had problems, he'd sit with them on the bench that I was sitting on at the time and talk. He'd mainly listen. After a while, he'd say, "Shall we plant something now?" And then they would. Prisoners all over the prison raved about him and how his low-key work had built trust, skills, and hope in them. We saw similar work going on in woodwork, furniture upholstery, the gym, education, in drug treatment, and on some wings. On these wings, officers built outstanding relationships and maximised ordinary situations in ways that supported whatever courses, work, or education prisoners were engaged in. Or they got them engaged in something in the first place against the odds. Prisoners said they felt acknowledged. Some described starting and finishing things for the first time in their lives with encouragement from staff. These officers' model of prisoners was of complex people on a journey, and they collaborated with specialist staff of all grades and varieties to support prisoners on their unique personal development trajectory. Staff derived huge satisfaction from making a difference to an individual, even when this difference was quite small. These small differences often turned into large differences, for example, culminating in my second case in the downgrade of a prisoner at Frankland after 32 years on Cat A. There are countless other examples, and what these examples share is a kind of determination which is embodied in their professional identities to move people forward from wherever they happen to be to somewhere better, and I want to come back to this. So the project that generated all this activity and talk was a two-year study funded by the ESRC's Transforming Social Science Scheme. You can see it was called Locating Trust in a Climate of Fear: Religion, Moral Status, Prisoner Leadership, and Risk in a Maximum Security Prison, or in Maximum Security Prisons. I have a feeling it's my conversations about this project that got me invited to where I was earlier today, because one of the themes was intelligent fear. That's not the language that was being used, but distinguishing between rational fear and mad fear. And there's resonances with what I want to say. So this was a competitive call for funding intended to support groundbreaking high-risk research. And I carried out this project with my colleagues. Ruth is in the room, I can see her, Ryan Williams and Richard Bramwell. One of the innovations in this study has been to include expertise in religious studies, but also in hip-hop, rap and cultural studies in the research team. And we've just sort of started writing. We're still analysing, and we plan to write a book called Prisons and the Problem of Trust. The particular decision to place trust at the heart of the project came about as a result of a finding in a previous project at Whitemore. Some of you might notice there are some resonances in our current plan with an important predecessor. So in some ways, both our methodology and our theoretical interest is a development of the Sparks, Bottoms and Hay study of order in two contrasting high security prisons carried out in the late 1980s. Tony might have touched on some of this work this morning. So one of our headline findings is that we've also found very different forms of order in each of the prisons in our study. So different types of relationships, different approaches to the rules, different values, and different outcomes and challenges arising as a result. What's different in our study is the focus on trust in particular, and in the prominent role of race, religion, and risk thinking in the new, some people call it, post-9/11 world. So as a very brief background, Whitemore 1, as I now call it, was my favourite ever and least funded study. There might be a relationship between those two things. It was conducted in 1998-9 with my colleague David Price, using a method called a priest of inquiry, to explore the best aspects of the complex and highly skilled work that prison officers do. This study in itself arose out of the findings of an evaluation of incentives and earned privileges when it was first introduced, which showed that officers use different types of power on different wings, and that those forms of power that operated through relationships were the most effective. This mainly observational study described the importance of discretion or making exceptions and peacekeeping in the work of prison officers. At their best, experienced prison officers made evaluative judgments about individual prisoners, detected and anticipated threats to order, and cajoled prisoners into compliance using talk, kind humour, straightness, and the right combination of scepticism and trust. These are refined skills which are difficult to describe, although officers call the use of them common sense. The problem for prison officers is that if they do their work exceptionally well, then nothing happens. This makes it very hard to evaluate and appreciate. So we explored how much work goes into achieving a quiet day. And this study became, alongside some other work, the prison officer. Prison officers still tell me that they recognise this account of their work. Prisoners at the time that we carried out this first Whitemore study described staff-prisoner relationships as generally good and close, and the regime as broadly legitimate, despite lots of pains and frustrations that they also described. This study predates MQPL, for those of you who know that language. It sort of led to it. So we didn't formally measure the climate. The analysis at the time was largely qualitative. So when I was asked to return to Whitemore in 2008-10, it was a shock to find the world transformed. 55% of the prisoners were black, Asian or mixed race, compared to about 25% the first time. 40% were Muslim. I understand those figures are now 65% and 45%. Staff were distant and uncomfortable, and prisoners were angry and alienated. The combined effects of longer, indeterminate and joint enterprise sentences, I understand you've heard a lot about this from Ben just now, a more remote new penological senior management team, a political climate requiring a public acceptability test for creative or meaningful activities for prisoners, and anxieties about radicalisation and the meaning of in-prison conversion to Islam had squeezed out humanity and trust. So this is the report of what I now call Whitemore 2. It was published in 2011. Prisoners described being behind the slab, not being a person, feeling trapped and closed in. Life was vague and muddy. They felt lost in the system. Prisoners used the words alone, struggle, anxiety, and insignificant to reflect their feelings of being hidden from the world at large and fending for themselves, as well as somewhat fearful of those around them. These prisoners were the new generation serving new generation sentences in a new penological late modern prison. But this was also a religiously divided climate. These conditions were generating considerable frustration, despair, and anger, as well as violence. The violence and many of the threats of violence were constructed and presented as about faith. It was never completely clear what was going on. So faith was, in the words of Michael Spurr, when he talked back to us about our findings, faith was the new no-go area. These conditions were, or we described these conditions and the prison as paralysed by distrust. Bora Kant read our report and described it as heartbreaking. Someone just described Ben's presentation as heartbreaking. We're describing similar experiences, I think, with complementary populations, and that just about summed it up. We used Axel Honneth's analysis of the struggle for recognition to describe what we saw going on. Staff no longer knew or recognised their prisoners, but experienced them as dangerous and unfathomable. This was understandable, but damaging. So far from upholding social order, the form of imprisonment we described was damaging character. It was generating anger and alienation. There were stringent requirements for prisoners to adhere to the rules, but there was no clear meaning or purpose and little legitimacy. So the study was really uncomfortable to conduct. The very much the opposite of the first study, which was completely delightful to conduct. So we somehow felt that even we were carrying risk thinking into the prison in a way that we hadn't 12 years earlier. There were other problems too. There were some prisoners we never managed to approach, even after a year of intensive fieldwork, because we were, like the staff, detecting distancing looks. We were never sure how far they were real. And so that return study became, for me, unfinished business. I've written about it quite a lot, including methodologically, for anyone who wants to find out more or provide counselling. This was a truly difficult topic, conceptually, empirically, and emotionally. And I wasn't sure at the time how much I wanted to or thought I had sufficient skill, resilience, or courage to carry on. So I was looking for hope and more tailored expertise, and I found it in my new unprisonised colleagues and in a call for transformative social science proposals from the ESRC. So the key message from the Whitemore 2 study was that empirical differences in levels of trust in prison have major consequences for life in those prisons. There were risks that overreactive security reporting could alienate those prisoners who were trying to make progress, and those prisoners who were more knowledgeable and pro-social about Islam, or who were peacekeepers on the wing. A lack of trust between security departments and chaplains or education staff was disabling, and prisoners were using this new no-go area of faith practices to challenge staff power. It was a very effective strategy. Staff were out of their depth and on unfamiliar territory. So, reconceptualising the problem, which we're now describing as a problem of risk, recognition, and the moral self, as a problem of trust, opened the way for closer and more meaningful dialogue, as well as more accurate measurement. So we sought out two other high security prisons, believed to be somewhat above the very low trust threshold we described at Whitemore at the time, and deciding to go into this risky, murky territory for a second time via trust was both a transformative and communicative decision. The very word attracted trust, openness, and interest. So prisoners would sidle up to us this time. Are you the guys who are studying trust? The word seemed to say to prisoners and to some staff that we were people with imagination, moral energy, and interested in possibilities and continua. So what lay at the other end of the obsession with risk? There was hope in trust, and prisoners understood that and made us feel very welcome. So you won't be surprised to hear me say this was a situation in need of appreciative inquiry. So this has turned out to be probably my most appreciative study methodologically. The very language of an appreciative inquiry has important outcomes embedded in it, so it helps to build grounded generative theory. It helps to create a humanistic and intimate research encounter, as well as to get at the full account. So our interviews start with, tell me about an aspect of yourself or your life that you're most proud of. This sets the agenda, and prisoners respond with surprise and then engagement to this question. So they hear the message, this is about who they are and not how they've been socially constructed by others. because it wasn't designed into the two Whitmore studies to be longitudinal, it was a sort of accidental longitudinal study, some of our understanding of precisely what had changed between the two periods was speculative. And as I said, it was quite difficult to reach some of the more influential leaders in the prison, as well as talk meaningfully about distinctions between varieties of Islam with prisoners. So we decided to build in two prisons to try and sharpen the analysis in the same way that Sparks et al. Had done in Prisons and the Problem of Order. So we took advice on where higher levels of trust might be found. Phil Sutton and Frankland appealed because the chaplaincy team at Frankland had responded with enthusiasm to presentations on our Whitmore study, and one of the chaplaincy led a prison band consisting of a tact prisoner, a Muslim, a Catholic, an in-prison convert to Islam, and a Christian. And we thought this was a good sign. Phil Sutton had invited us to visit following a research presentation, and we're enthusiastic to host the research too. So the four of us on the project spent much of the next year and a half trekking up and down to York and then Durham, spending around 6 months each in each prison. Some of the prisoners at Frankland had been in the Whitmore study and met us when we arrived in the welcome committee, and they campaigned for a dialogue group because they'd been in this previous study where we'd had a dialogue group and they'd liked this approach and opportunity. So they were kind of waiting for us, asked for this, and we said yes. Then, in an accident of enthusiasm, we were invited to carry out an MQPL Plus exercise in a third prison, Longlartin, which also starred in Tony's book, so that's all been quite exciting too. So we used the project revised version of our questionnaire when we did so. So we've ended up with data from three prisons, but the qualitative data is much more in-depth from Phil Sutton and Frankland. The original MQPL survey, which we developed in prisons and their moral performance, it actually had trust in it, but it got dropped in the version we developed for NOMS, because NOMS didn't like trust at the time, mainly because it didn't work like the other dimensions. So whereas dimensions like humanity just work upwards, so the more humanity you have, the better, trust isn't like that. This is the problem of trust, that there are upper limits. So if staff trust prisoners too much, then they escape, as we discovered in one of our prisons. So this is the problem of trust. Too little, and the social world ceases to work. But too much of the wrong kind, and very bad things happen. And the right place is a pinhead. So we're using a Nora O'Neill's concept of intelligent trust. That's why I like my new term, intelligent fear. This is aligning the placing of trust with trustworthiness to inform our thinking. So in this project, we've developed three additional dimensions of the quality of life to carry out this work. So if I can see them, trust here, intelligent trust, and political charge. I'll say about a little bit more about these next. So the term political charge was used almost in passing by Mark Hamm in his research on prisoner radicalisation. He found, in his comparison of Folsom and New Folsom prisons in the States, drawing on the accounts of prisoners and staff, but also informed by his analysis of 61 cases of extremist violence that had some form of in-prison component to the narrative, that radicalisation occurs only under specific conditions of confinement. So he argues in his book, which is called The Spectacular Few, that there are clashing viewpoints on prisoner radicalisation. There's what he calls the alarmist position, which is prisons are incubators for radical Islam, etc. There's what he calls the reassurance position. No, it's not. Islam contributes to rehabilitation. And then thirdly, his position, which is, and it's what he found, that radicalisation occurs in what he called failed state, mismanaged or understaffed prisons. These prisons generate what he called political charge, anger and alienation, which he said could be felt on the yards and landings. So we're sort of testing this hypothesis quite closely. And the term political charge is much more helpful, we think, than the term radicalisation, as it's less narrow or fixated on a specific outcome. So in a general model of prison quality, we're arguing that high levels of political charge are undesirable, and they lead to many unwanted outcomes, including disorder and suicide. So, if any of you know it, it works a bit like distress in relation to suicide. So, this is political charge. We're attempting to measure it, prisoner anger and alienation, to see whether it's being generated by different high-security prison climates. These are the items in the new dimension. It's sort of anger and alienation with a bit of fight or hatred of the state and its institutions, or collective identification in it. So you can see, I think, why it might be relevant. The shame and acceptance items are taken from the defiance literature, which suggests that these are inhibited by feelings of illegitimacy. The others have been developed from conversations with prisoners, from interview transcripts, and a workshop we had with Professor Suzanne Carstett, who works in this field, and we found it has very high reliability. So we have lots of examples of this in the interviews. It's come up in the interviews a lot, whether we've asked about it. Obviously, we don't ask directly about it, but it's come up in conversations about prisoners' experience. And it's sometimes expressed using religious or political language, as in the example here. So this is a prisoner, he's actually talking about being on probation, or being recalled because he got annoyed and made a sarcastic remark to his probation officer about the way he was being assumed to be risky. And so you can see, if my little pointer works, that yeah, he starts to express this anger, but in sort of religious language. So political charge is ill feeling brought about by the system, the route into the system, or in prison, for example, by comments made by particular officers, or by feeling targeted or forgotten about. Often it was linked to a feeling shared by many prisoners that we're not seeing that any work is going on to facilitate progress, personal development, or meaningful ways of surviving and getting through long sentences. In this context, speculative, careless, or sometimes malicious security reporting could set prisoners back years. Trust in the fairness of the authorities, or its openness to reason and change, was lost. So I quote, "I became really disheartened with the system," and many prisoners describe this process vividly. I'm quoting, "All I've learned is to hate authority more. The next time, that person will have so much hatred against authority, when he gets chased by the police, instead of putting his hand up, he might say, 'F word, I'd rather be dead than go back to you. You see where I'm coming from.' This is obviously a very dangerous frame of mind to be generating." Black and Muslim prisoners were somewhat more likely to express these kinds of feelings, especially in some prisons. The feelings didn't always begin in prison, but they could be intensified, for example, when a phone call was cut off when a Muslim prisoner gave an Arabic greeting to his family. That builds hatred for them, he said. So here's a prisoner convicted of a serious offence of extremist violence, talking about his trajectory or identity. And as with many of our interviewees, anger about racism predates anger about Iraq or Syria or whatever. He describes having to counter this racism with a racism of my own. His alienation began on the streets, in school, and in the face of police harassment. The offence he committed makes him look anti-West, but he grew up in London, he had white friends, he loved school, he reiterated these details at points in his interview, and he talked meaningfully about his appreciation of the few officers who'd been respectful or even kind to him since his imprisonment. Race, we've noticed, barely appears in accounts of radicalisation or extremist violence, but it's an important part of the story. So, whoops, here's the pattern for political charge. Most of you, I kind of assume people know a little bit about the MQPL and how we score it. It's on a 5-point scale. 3 is kind of neutral, anything above it is positive, and anything below it is negative. So the pattern in our 3 prisons for political charge was highly informative. Each prison had a significantly different overall mean score, with a step change between them from a low 2.6 at Full Sutton to a significantly higher 2.72 at Long Larton to an almost neutral 2.95 at Langland. So in other words, the differences between these figures are statistically significant even when they're not quite statistically significant, the difference in terms of the feeling on the wings in the prison is very substantially significant. So we felt these differences. So Full Sutton had a more charged atmosphere, Long Larton felt lighter, and at Frankland, despite vigilant security over movements, for example, prisoners were much less tense. They engaged with staff, so we overheard conversations between staff and prisoners about sentence planning on the outdoor walkways. The almost neutral score at Frankland doesn't mean we didn't find any anger and alienation. We found a lot of it. So there were still significant numbers of prisoners agreeing with angry statements. So 31% of prisoners still agreed that my time in prison had made me angry, but this was compared to 46% agreeing with this statement at Full Sutton. So these are differences of degree. White prisoners generally reported lower levels of political charge, that is, higher scores, except at Long Larton, the only prison where black prisoners reported less. These are statistical data, but they very much tally with our qualitative data in the interviews where prisoners said Long Larton is a good prison to be if you're black or mixed race. In all three prisons, Muslim prisoners reported higher levels of political charge, but the differences between the other prisoners in each prison and the experience of Muslim prisoners varied quite a lot. So it was made clear to us in interviews that being black in Long Larton was less of an added problem than being Muslim in Long Larton, or being either black or Muslim in Full Sutton. Being Muslim was associated with higher political charge in Full Sutton than in Frankland, for reasons that became clear in the qualitative data. In all prisons, being influential, being high risk, and being all sorts of other things were also dangerous assets. We hypothesised that not all our dimensions are linear, and that some may have tipping points below which major events might be more likely to arise or major changes in the climate can be felt. So, and there's a reason I'm using this as an example, we decided that a prison that starts to get a score, this is a low score of about 2.50, has very high levels of political charge on it, which can begin to get dangerous. So prisoners described how on a wing like this, there wouldn't be much support for letting the staff know that, for example, a hostage taking might be about to happen. On a wing where there's better relationships and lower levels of political charge, prisoners would say things like, that officer came to see me in the segregation unit. I now feel if I ever knew she was going to be at risk, I would make sure a member of staff knew about it. So these figures are relevant to things that prisoners will and won't do. If we take the overall results for intelligent trust, there's something very different going on between staff and prisoners, or between the system and prisoners in each prison. So again, the dimension means are significantly different. So this time the dimension means are at the bottom, 2.57 at Full Sutton, a significantly higher 2.71 at Long Larton, and then again, a much higher 2.91, still negative, but much closer to neutral at Frankland. And if we look at the two items, I feel recognised as the person I am in this prison, and I have opportunities to show I'm trustworthy in this prison, the scores are highly informative. Prisoners felt unrecognised at Full Sutton, less so at Long Larton, but much less so at Frankland, which shows a just over a neutral score of 3.02. There are, according to prisoners, more opportunities to show I can be trustworthy at Long Larton, and again, significantly so at Frankland. None of these scores are high, but they're substantial differences. So we're arguing that these differences matter, and that they're grounded in the ways that prison officers approach, think about, and treat prisoners. So to move out to the broader picture, we've got some working hypotheses in the project, which are, first, that faith identities and faith conversations will be of a different nature in prisons where intelligent trust flows. So some intelligent trust generates constructive faith exploration or faith identities, as well as facilitates personal growth, which lowers the risk of violence, whereas lower trust produces narrower and more oppositional faith identities and behaviours. That secondly, higher levels of trust generally characterise a prison. Excuse me. So trust is like a fragile plant. Once you get it going, it will grow. It's asymmetric, so it grows very slowly and can be lost in an instant. But where it starts to grow across the prison. Thirdly, linked to the first, that prisons will differ in the amount of political charge they generate. So failed state prisons paralysed by distrust generate more political charge and therefore more dangerous or power-laden faith identities, as well as leading to stagnation and damage to well-being and character. And then finally, there's a bit of classic prison sociology in the background, that different sorts of prisoners will be esteemed or will rise to the top of the prison hierarchy, carrying influence in these different kinds of climates. So in other words, intelligent trust influences faith, it influences leadership, and it influences personal development. So these apologies for the millions of figures, but I wanted to try and put all of the results onto one slide to show you the overall picture. And this time I've put Whitmore 2 back in order to show that there's some interesting distinctions going on here. So in general, Full Sutton looked like Whitmore 2. So if we insert Whitmore back in, we can see that those two prisons, Whitmore and Full Sutton, had low scores on relational and professional dimensions, but much higher scores on security dimensions. So anything that's shaded in yellow is above the threshold of 3, so the more yellow, the better. And if you just take one or two examples, so I think, here's my pointer, if we take staff-prisoner relationships, there's a sort of step change as we move from left to right, with quite significant increases in most of the dimensions as we go across the figures. So in the end, in our heads, we've divided the prisons now into two pairs, with Full Sutton and Whitmore looking one way and Longlaughton and Frankland looking and scoring very differently. They had lighter and more individualised climates and significantly higher scores on relational and care dimensions. So you see a gain in quality from left to right on most dimensions, with only Frankland making it over the threshold on staff-prisoner relationships and staff professionalism, for example. So the prisons seem to fall into two categories. What we might call the new penological, Whitmore and Full Sutton, characterised by vigilant security, distinct professionalism, the meeting of targets, proactive rule following, but a form of professionalism that's related mainly to risk management, and the old penological, or old school, Longlaughton and Frankland, which were characterised by a different form of professionalism relating to the development or progress of prisoners and much higher levels of engagement. Staff in these prisons had different, longer narratives about prisoners. They used more discretion. They carried some risk or managed risk through trust. So prisoners in Full Sutton said, you feel like a statistic, whereas in Franklin they said, you feel like a person. Obviously the composition and geographical location of each prison was distinctive, impacting on the orientation of staff and their perceived levels of power and control. The four prisons each operated to a distinct underlying model or form of order, which lay along a continuum with quite different constructions of dangerousness. So this was shaping the prisoner experience to the extent that expressions of religious faith were distinctive in these different climates. So in Frankland, in the least charged atmosphere, expressing normal religious doubt was permissible, for example. Prisoners invited each other to religious celebrations. Interfaith dialogue was normalised. This was much less the case in the other two prisons. So, in the way that we do this kind of thing, our overall results suggest that our hypotheses are supported. So when we try and look for explanations of these variations in levels of political charge, there is, you'll see, a sort of legitimacy explanation. So political charge was explained by differences in levels of humanity, bureaucratic legitimacy, fairness, decency, and the quality of relationships. In other words, these variations were an outcome of the prison's moral climate. In an extensive discussion about a very serious incident at Fulsun that looked like extremist violence, prisoners said, "The attack that happened, that is hothead guys, there's no doubt about that. But sometimes hothead guys just need a trigger. And the trigger was actually the prison institution pulled the trigger." This incident was described by prisoners as emotional rather than political or religious. So this is delicate territory, I realise, but the wing it happened on, E Wing, was a wing with markedly lower scores on all dimensions within an already low-end range, and amongst the lowest score for bureaucratic legitimacy. So this is E Wing, and obviously we do this kind of study all the time, so it's obvious to us that E Wing is very much an outlier with results that are much lower than the other wings in a generally low profile, and that this score for bureaucratic legitimacy is among the lowest that we'd seen. This hostage-taking incident of a member of staff by three Muslim prisoners at Fulsun was a terrible incident, and we're not arguing in any way that our scores were predictive or that these events are predictable. But we are suggesting that very low and outlier scores should precipitate concern and remedial action. The prisoners talked at length about this incident with considerable concern throughout the project. If we move back to the more general story, here's a path analysis for Frankland only, where the mechanisms seem to be clearest. Higher scores on bureaucratic legitimacy, staff-prisoner relationships, and humanity in particular lead to higher scores on both trust and intelligent trust, which in turn lead to lower political charge, and these relationships are significant. There are some other important wing differences in each prison. So, for example, Frankland's Westgate and the Pipe, so this is Frankland, again, the scores are quite varied. This is not such a good profile here, but you'll see by the yellow that Pipe and the Westgate are the yellowest prisons we've ever measured. So these are special, psychologically supported wings that are aimed at fostering good relationships, support, engagement, socially creative initiatives, and growth and progression. So they have the highest scores of any prison we've measured to date, matching Grendon on all dimensions. And its personal development score was something like 4.15. And its political charge score was very high and well over the threshold. By high, I mean good rather than poor. These evaluations were striking and very consistent with our qualitative observations.
I just wanted to ask, in terms of full set, was there any difference in the population that was on the wing? Was it longer term prisoners for foreign nationals? Was there any other variables?
Not obviously. I'll try and come back to that a bit later. I don't think these differences were explained by population differences very much. What's important is the way in which this close, slightly unfair look at individual wings and establishments is helping us to understand the more general picture, if you like, our kind of theoretical framework, which is showing that prisoners are more able to explore a religion, develop an interest, or work on their futures in wings with, and I don't mean this officially, enabling or rehabilitative cultures. So I don't want to get confused with the enabling environments world, but use the enabling world to mean something positive and rehabilitative. If I show you, we've been doing some research to see what else we can find, that to see whether there are some prisons that share this profile. And obviously, we knew that Grendon is always a candidate. So we've also recently found some results from Warren Hill. So these are whole establishments in these cases, and they're in the same sort of league. There might be others, and we'd love to know about them. My point is that scores of this quality, these yellow prisons, 4.10 for staff prisoner relationships, 3.99 for respect, all high for staff professionalism, 7.32 for overall quality of life, over 3 for bureaucratic legitimacy. These are pretty outstanding scores. And what they mean in practice is that there's much more than the usual handful of outstanding individual staff doing great work against the odds. This is something very different. There's something distinctive embedded in the culture and in the orientation towards prisoners. So, this project has resulted in some really careful thinking about some of the differences between enabling in the broadest sense and disabling environments in general. That there are such differences between prisons of the same type and wings within prisons suggests that there is much scope for improvement and that there's much we could be learning from the highest scoring places. So a disabling environment looks like this. So we have lots of examples I won't go into. But these kinds of orientations undo trust and make prisons dangerous places for all concerned. I'll skip over this slide, which is a complex slide, which just is at the beginnings of our process of trying to show that the qualitative data is helping us to show that there are very strong links between the kinds of differences that I'm outlining here and the leadership and social organisation among prisoners, from a kind of power-seeking structure to a much more collaborative and rehabilitative culture. So the model we're building of prison quality looks a bit like this. We're also building a positively expressed version of it, which I'll show you in a moment. And I've been attracted to this concept of the failed state prison, even though it's not popular with everyone, because it seems to me to represent the data, but also to take the legitimacy framework further. So this term, failed state, has been used in studies of political violence to explain variations in levels of terrorist activities in different countries. And theorists of political violence outside of prison are identifying factors like perceptions of powerlessness and discrimination, religious and intergroup conflict, power and leadership struggles, population change, and so on, that can be adapted to or that seem to make sense in the prison environment. So these dynamics, including a lack of hope and meaning, lack of fairness, lack of recognition, and a significant decline in already low levels of trust, undo the kind of dynamic security that keeps prisons safe. So we're just suggesting that this concept of political charge might be a useful intermediate variable in the same way that distress has been in our suicide studies. So stated more appreciatively, we can start to model the kinds of conditions that support more legitimate and well-ordered regimes and add in some of the macro variables or the large-scale social external variables to the prison quality story already under consideration. So we might add in, for example, acceptable sentencing policy and practice, the taming of risk thinking, better management of the politics and economics of prison life and quality, professionally prepared prison officers, outstanding senior management teams, the provision of rehabilitative and other meaningful activities to prisoners, and so on. So I'm nearly there. I just want to try and describe how we're thinking about this set of results theoretically. And our claim is that higher quality or enabling environments are oriented towards prisoners in a distinctive way, which is captured by Martin Buber, a theologian, who talks about I-it versus I-thou relations. I-thou encounters approach whole people as they are, via attentiveness to detail, so as a person, and not, for example, as a Muslim or as a danger. As he puts it, as an experiencing subject and not an experienced object. The short story from our qualitative data is that we've found that prisoners describe becoming human in I-thou relationships with all kinds of staff, and that this often triggers, or at the very least supports, a process of growth and change. We've been watching staff do this and getting them to talk about it, and they're using the very best of ordinary prison officer skills, sometimes with some additional psychological understanding, to do it. So, the distinctive characteristic of prison officers at their best is that they seem to work in a way that's consistent with what Christian Smith calls a concept of emergent personhood. If our working account of the person is flat and narrow, then we can't support potent human creative capacities. He argues that realizing our personhood is an innate drive. In other words, we have emergent properties that require relationships with others, as well as structures of social relations to realize. And seeing the prisoner as an emergent person and acting accordingly seems to be transformational. This is what outstanding officers do when they have time and institutional support. We've been trying to do something a bit like that in our project methodologically, but officers seem to do it better. The third skill that outstanding prison officers have, whether they know it or not, is doing what Iris Murdoch described as the most crucial moral virtue, a kind of attentiveness to detail, a wise, trained capacity for vision, which can see what's really going on in a situation and respond accordingly. And this is extraordinarily complex. One of the reasons I rate it so highly is because I know just how difficult it was for us to achieve this in Whitemoor. So I have realised in the last few months that how I think about the research task is not a million miles away from how I'm beginning to think about the best prison officer work. The difference is we just have to do the authentic description, and prison officers have to read the situation right and then act on it. So what officers are doing when they do it well is reading the situation, drawing on what sociologist Anthony Giddens calls practical consciousness, skills lying beyond the realm of verbal expression. And in a way, they have to read a more complex situation right all the time. So in today's multicultural world, in which we imprison minorities, foreigners, and immigrants increasingly unevenly, in which Islam is the fastest growing religion in prison, and in which young men live a street life that's oppositional, materialistic, and infused by drugs, prison officers have to be experts in culture, youth, and religion in order to be experts in the use of discretion and in distributions of trust. And this is extraordinarily difficult. So, finally, one of the reasons I've pursued this line of inquiry is because I was left feeling so uncomfortable at the end of Whitemoor 2, that in my view, and this has been my conversation earlier today, I don't think we can go on if we give up faith in trust. And what we saw troubled me because it felt like we were collectively creating violence via misrecognition, over-sentencing, and risk mania. And so I was left particularly uncomfortable by my own inability to approach one or two prisoners and engage them in conversation because their representation and reputations were so other. In this project, I think we've broken through that barrier and we've found other people doing that too exceptionally well. And I've become reassured that there are always ways through and that once the talk starts, everything becomes possible, including the possibility that the high-risk label is wrong. So as in the quote here, I think if we avoid catching the prisoner's gaze, as Giddens puts it, then we become part of the problem. So I'll end there. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's a sobering way to end the day, but rightly sobering too, and thank you very much for that presentation. We've got a few minutes for questions, and one right at the back. Go on.
Alex, throughout your work, when you've been doing the study that you've been doing over the last 18 months or so, you've talked very eloquently there about the prison officer and the skill of the prison officer. And we know as a service that we found it quite difficult to recruit new prison officers in. And what I'm seeing as a prison governor are 22-year-old kids that, as the prisoners tell me, last worked at Tesco's, what skills they bring into the job. Did you identify or observe the skill set that we need to be encouraging prison staff to develop, either internally or what we need to recruit in to be able to do that job as you described it?
Could you just hold that for...
Fine.
Yes, I see. Right. Any more? Anybody? Please, yes. Yes. Okay.
Just going back to your findings on the Pike and the Westgate, Alison. Bureaucratic legitimacy was low in both those places, despite everything else being very high.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had any thoughts as to whether that was directed at the role of the officer in those places, or whether the fact that they're psychologically informed environments with heavy psychology input is actually working against us
right.
in those places.
Okay.
One more, if there is. Yes. Okay.
Alison, I'm just interested to know, out of all those studies, what the start prisoner ratio was?
Everywhere. Whether that's the factor.
Okay. Well, sure. Could you have a go at those three and then
we'll see what... Yeah, these are huge. Thank you for these questions. They are huge. And Ian, the problem is, I'm still doing this work, so I'm kind of finding the officers who I think embody what we saw at its best, and I'm trying to interview them to death so I can find out what it is about those officers. And we had a bit of a conversation about this in the MST sessions the last couple of days, that some people bring experience that's got nothing to do with recruitment or training. But if I can sum it up, what the really outstanding officers and other staff seem to do is this right use of authority. So somehow they can be humane, helpful and organised, and they leave room for the placing of intelligent trust, and they do all of this with lots of professional confidence, and they're also prepared to use coercion. So these skills are discernment skills. And the problem with that, I think recruitment makes a difference. I think remuneration makes a difference. I think people learn them, if they've got the potential, they learn them with experience, which means the prison service needs to retain staff. So this is, in my mind, this is turning into a bit of a rally for a different way of thinking about prison officers, which I think means not just more attention being paid to recruitment and training, but professionalising and valuing and supporting officers much better. So the ones that we see often have they might be at very different stages in their professional development. They bring some of this in with them, but then the structures seem to support the best that they bring. So that's kind of linked, I think, to the third question, which was about numbers. And obviously I don't want to say that this is all about numbers, because we've seen officers in non-pipes and non-enabling environments doing these kinds of things. But I did say that there was something about officers having the time and the institutional structures. One of the things that we're seeing, that we're excited about in both Full Sutton and Frankland, is that there seems to be activity being generated which officers are becoming part of, and it feels like somehow they're getting permission. They're kind of getting permission, I know, both from the governors and from prisoners to work in this very new kind of way. So I think sometimes the skills are out there, but officers don't feel they have kind of cultural permission to display them. So it's not all about resources. And then secondly, Sarah, you asked me about bureaucratic legitimacy. I think the levels were actually, they were low, but they're always low because of what I imagine Ben has been talking to you about, because long-term prisoners are now serving so much longer than they used to and in such complicated ways, and it's so difficult to navigate their way through sentences, and officers don't always feel that they have the resources and skills to help them through, and the programmes might not be suitable or available. Bureaucratic legitimacy is about the structure of the sentence. The score varies, so officers can make a difference, but it's the dimension, it's why my model is kind of impossibly for all of you, has got this distal causes section in it, because sentencing and the policy climate and all of these changing compositions of the prison population, they're actually making it much harder for even outstanding senior managers to make even outstanding staff persuade prisoners that their sentences are legitimate. And maybe you can't say that, but we can, because it's what we found.
Okay, thank you. We've got time if there is one last question that anybody wants to ask.
Bethany.
Yes, please.
Under political charge, can you talk how
you
derived the tipping point number, the 2.50.
Yeah. We worked outwards from E-Wing for Sutton in particular, but also from some other wings. So we basically looked at the range. We gathered, we haven't analysed our qualitative data systematically yet, but we just know, because of things that prisoners said and things that we felt in our own skin, that this felt like a dangerous wing to be on. So I guess what I was looking for was what we felt at Whitemoor and couldn't penetrate, why it felt like you couldn't walk into this wing and feel safe. And we wanted to understand what that felt like, what it looked like, why it was happening, and whether it was real. So I think we've placed the threshold where we and staff and prisoners describe that feeling, and it comes out at about 2.50.
Okay. Alison, thank you very much.